Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Peter Hodi. Peter is the editor-in-chief of FinNews, a leading online news portal reporting about the financial sector in Switzerland. Peter has been in journalism, TV, print, and digital media for the past 20 years. He has an MBA in media management and a deep interest in the commercial side of publishing. And now, to the interview. Hi, Peter, and thanks a lot for taking time today.
Thank you for having me.
Peter, we spoke last about 2 years ago about fintech, mainly for a documentary film I made about fintech in Switzerland. And what kind of changes have you seen since that time in the Swiss financial landscape?
Fintech was regarded as a disruptive part of the financial system in Switzerland. And in the past 2 years, I think it has more shifted into a collaborative part of the financial system, especially the Swiss banks, because mainly most fintechs or a large part of the Swiss fintechs have become partners of Swiss banking rather than disrupting the Swiss banking.
That's what everybody said back then. They said, oh, our biggest goal is to collaborate with the banks. So that has happened.
That has happened partly because they realized that they can't do business on their own because of the large cost of expanding an own business, starting from scratch. And partly also because banks realized that they cannot innovate by themselves. It has come to the decision by many banks regarding digitization, industrialization of their value chain. Is it make or buy? And most of the banks decided we buy it because the cost of buying is probably lower than developing on their own.
So they bought these fintechs or did they just enter in partnerships?
Some of them bought fintechs or bought shares of the fintechs to tie them to their businesses. Others just cooperate. There are very few banks that open their systems, that open their APIs. Open banking is a big buzzword in the international banking, not in Switzerland, where banks there were quite reluctant of opening their APIs to fintechs. But there are some, and they're quite successful by doing so because they open their horizon of businesses, building an ecosystem. Yeah, and that's also another buzzword now in banking and in fintech especially.
Yes, and yet another buzzword is blockchain technology.
Exactly,
so,
yes.
You said also there was a shift kind of the fintech, you know, focus on fintech as the main disruptor now toward cryptocurrencies and blockchain companies.
Exactly. Another development in the past 2 or 3 years in Switzerland is the sharp upcoming of the crypto business in Switzerland. We have already a large variety of firms, Swiss firms, mostly international firms, though, that came to Switzerland to build their crypto business, be it a crypto storage, crypto asset management, crypto funds, crypto consulting, or companies that just want to do their ICOs here, their initial coin offerings.
Yeah, and Switzerland also branded itself as Crypto Nation, I think, or?
I mean, of course, the upcoming of the crypto business in Switzerland is also carried by pretty smart marketing in Zug. We have Dolphy Müller, the president of the city of Zug, I think. The mayor of the city of Zug, who branded Zug as the new crypto valley. Zug has made quite a few transformations in the past decades, being a hub for commodity firms, being an attraction for with their low taxes, and now it has become an attraction for crypto companies because low taxes is one thing. Because of marketing, I mean, if you have like three or four firms that believe in a place, then they attract the others. I think that that has been an effect, and of course, the Swiss quite liberal regulation concerning cryptos and crypto assets.
You just mentioned the marketing part of Switzerland promoting itself as the haven, right, for crypto startups and blockchain companies. How do you see these companies or even the regulators and the politicians and the individual, you know, maybe cantons, how do you see them promote themselves in that field?
Well, you know, the whole crypto nation thing has to be seen in a larger context, in my opinion. You have the Swiss banking, which, especially in the international views, but also in Switzerland, is it viewed, it's on a constant decline. The importance of Swiss banking in relation to the whole Swiss economy has been on a decline. The workforce has diminished. And in general, it isn't as much fun to work in Swiss banking as it used to be 10 or 15 years ago. So,
I mean, are there layoffs?
Yes, there have been there are constantly layoffs because you have in banking, you have the margin pressure, you have rising costs by regulation, and so on. I mean, that's well known. So that is a topic in politics, right? And Swiss is in fear of losing its stance as an international financial hub. So crypto marketers in general, right? Business entrepreneurs, PR companies, bankers that switch sides, they're quite smart in tapping into this political insecurity. And I think If a PR company or a association like Crypto Value Association or other lobbyists, if they play it smart and go to politicians, be it in a city, in a canton, or on a federal base, and lay out their case, I think it catches quite a bit of interest.
What is the case that they lay out?
Well, I mean, They lay out that cryptocurrencies, digital currencies, and blockchain economy is going to be the next big thing on a global scale, and that Switzerland has a big chance in being at the forefront of this development. And so far, they have proven right.
Yes, and I think they also really believe that, right? I mean, it's not just marketing and promotion. I think many of these companies are very convinced. That's
the future. True. I mean, but that's another story. I think. I mean, in the crypto scene, in my opinion, you have the strong believers. Then you have the ones that are strictly in for the business, and you have also the bankers that look for new opportunities to do their own thing. I think that has been, especially in the past year, a large driver in the Swiss crypto scene, that you have seen a lot of disappointed bankers give up their well-paid jobs, but obviously frustrating jobs in institutions that are constantly under pressure, and moving into crypto business, which is obviously evolving and is not tightly regulated and offers huge chances of making quick money.
Mm-hmm. that's the promise, right? That draws them into that business, maybe many people.
Of course, money always draws people into business, but it's also the prospects of being part of a larger development that could, you know, it could, I'm not sure, it could revolutionize the whole financial system. And that's what the believers are working at.
I mean, you're reporting a lot about the whole sector that includes everything, right? I mean, banks, fintechs, but also now the crypto space, the blockchain space. Where, just as a summary, who do you think are the main players there?
Well, I don't know if you're acquainted with the term the Old Boys Network. The Old Boys Network in Swiss finance was a network of people that have been running institutions that were politically connected and also in the army connected. And, you know, they ran quite a bit of the Swiss economy. And with the upcoming of fintech and more so of the crypto and blockchain business in Zurich, you start to see evolve also some kind of a network of people and persons that are connected to each other, that are in projects, that are in organizations that pursue projects. And I mean, you could see that when in January, when there was the crypto finance conference was organized in St. Moritz, which was a huge success. I mean, great marketing, huge success, great timing. And the people behind it, you know, I mean, like Mark Bernecker, Tobias Reichmuth, just to name those two, or bankers like Eric Sarrazin. Those are people that are, or David, Daniel Gutenberg, one of the early Facebook investors. Those people are coming from banking and finance and have been early in pursuing innovative businesses. Bernecker has been largely in fintech. Reichmuth has gone into sustainable investment. And if you look at their network and where what they are doing is, they influence a lot. That's my belief. I mean, if you look at Mark Bernecker, excuse me if I cite him again. I mean, he's in the task force, in the federal task force, blockchain task force in Bern. He is acquainted with all the crypto associations in Zug. He sits in the boards of some of the larger and more promising crypto currency projects in Switzerland. He is one of the organizers of the crypto finance conference. So those are the people. I mean, then you have Oliver Bussmann, of course, which plays a huge role in promoting Crypto Valley, in promoting blockchain economy, as the president of the Crypto Valley Association, but also is a very active investor and financier in this business. And in some way, they're all connected to each other. So there is there's a handful, maybe a dozen or two dozen of people that are really well connected. And I wouldn't say they run things, but they are ubiquitous. They're everywhere.
They're the new boys network.
They're the new boys network. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
And is that bad?
No. No, it's not bad. It's just, it depends, you know. I mean, it depends on how you look at things. Are they the believers? You know, are they just, I mean, are they believers like, I don't care if I get rich or not. I just want Bitcoin to be the new dollar in the world currency system. Or are they just, do they see business opportunities in it, which isn't, you know, isn't wrong at all? Or are they just in for the quick buck? You know, and I leave that open. I don't know.
Do you think that's kind of a feature of Switzerland almost, that you first had this old boys network of, you know, people kind of celebrating some kind of, you know, cronyism almost, helping each other out, patting each other's back. And now, you know, something similar is emerging with this whole crypto nation play. Do you think that's a Swiss feature, or have you seen that elsewhere?
I think that's it's not a Swiss feature. Switzerland helps, of course, because it's a small country. It's a small place. In Zurich, in banking, everybody knows everybody. I mean, it's a real small world. So it might be easier to build those connections and the network, but it's normal. I mean, it's not a special Swiss feature, I would think.
It's normal, but it's interesting that you have a technology that promises decentralization, yet you have this concentration of people who influence the perception of it, maybe at least.
That is an interesting thought, and it is contradictory, but I wouldn't know how you could, through a decentralized communication system, promote the idea of blockchain.
With Finnews, right, how do you filter some of this promotion, right? And how do you weed out what is the true story, what is the true motivation? How do you vet those stories that actually end up then on your platform?
Actually, that is a very difficult question that we deal with almost on a daily basis. We have seen a large inflow of marketing and PR regarding crypto and ICOs. And of course, every company that is starting a crypto business, every company that plans an ICO, of course, sells it as the world's best next idea. And it is very hard to find out what is behind it. Is there some serious business case behind it or not? Or the other way, you could look at it as from a journalistic point of view, is it a scam? You know, and if it's a huge scam, it could also be a good story. So that is very hard to define. It costs also quite a bit of resources to always research who is behind it, what do they do, is it serious, is it regulated, and so on. And we decide on being very selective on what we do part of Swiss finance.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to. I mean, it's a reputable news platform.
Of course, we have to. I mean, that is expected by us. I think we do it. If you hear from the crypto scene, we might not do it too often. They would expect more. But I think...
You mean they expect more coverage?
Yes, of course. I mean, we get almost daily calls, daily emails with offers. You could be our partner in launching this business. You could be our media partner or whatever. And of course, we look at these things, but mostly we decline.
Mostly we decline. What is their offer to you? I mean, how do they... What kind of value do they promise that they bring to you?
Well, the next big thing, to them, it's always a super large story. It's you know, a revolution in some kind of way, and it's very attractive to participate in the ICO because of the token that has some special features, and the value is going to rise. Blah blah blah. It's always kind of the same, and. I mean, if you look at the numbers, I mean, they're well known. Most of the ICOs are failures, right? So if you write about every ICO or about every crypto business that is available in Switzerland, you have a lot of faulty stories, and we try to avoid that.
When you say they're failures, you mean they don't raise any funds in their token sale?
No, most of them do. And but the tokens, the value of tokens might even rise for a moment, for a brief short of time, maybe weeks or months, but then they land at 0.0, and that's, in my view,
so it's classic pump and dump.
Maybe yes. I always say one should try to compare stories with failed ICOs with stories of failed startups in general. And I'm not sure about the numbers. I mean, I'm not sure how many startups do succeed and can develop from a startup into a well-developed company or in a small growing company, and how many fail, right? And I think I'm quite positive that most of the startups also fail, but I'm not sure about the numbers. So it is normal, and it is quite common that an ICO might become a failure because the company behind it has to prove that its business model works, and that is a different story.
So they may raise some funds in their token sale, but the business model still has no legs.
Exactly, and I mean that to me, if I would be a buyer of tokens, I would be very critical about it. You know, I mean, the big difference from an IPO to an ICO is a company with an IPO has, most of the time, has a reliable business model and has a proven track record in making revenues or even profit for existing shareholders, while companies that promote themselves through an ICO don't. They have a white paper.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of the ICO space, I think, is kind of extreme in that regard, right? I mean, you have a lot of froth and a lot of, attempted fraud, maybe even one could say.
Yes.
But there's also other businesses, right, who truly believe that what they're working on with blockchain technology, you know, with distributed ledgers, right. Decentralization is the future of many things, you know, beyond finance even. So there's like several tiers, right, of hype, so to speak.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at larger projects, you know, as an example, Tezos, which has made quite a few headlines in 2017, also through their ICO, which was huge, I think 230 million raised by, you know, some people, very smart people that have a proven track record of being great engineers or programmers. But it hasn't been clear for quite a few months if it's going to work, you know, if the Tezos blockchain is going to be built. Now it looks like it's going to be built. So there have to be some people behind it that represent something, you know, past as a successful whatever.
Banker. So it's about the people, about their track record.
I think so, yes. Yes.
And is that also what you're analyzing when you decide what to write about?
Most definitely, yes. Yes, I always go and check the names.
How do you go about checking into that, into the names and all that?
Well, it's quite easy today and nowadays. I mean, if you Google names and if you go into the relevant data banks, you find quite a bit of information about the person.
Like LinkedIn?
LinkedIn is also always a start. The central register for companies, for Swiss companies, is one, as an example. And, of course, you start asking around as well. That would be also a source of information.
Okay. If, let's say, somebody has a company, not an ICO, that they just want to promote for a quick token sale, but somebody truly believes they're working on something big, that, you know, it's going to change a lot of the things we're currently doing, you know, in the old school centralized way. Mm-hmm. How should they, in your view, go about making their story known?
Good question. I mean, what always helps, you know, is if the business is in some kind of relevance, be it socially, financially, economically, whatever, you know, and has it a disruptive character? Is it a true innovation, or is it just, you know, just something that produces a token while the business could work without it, without blockchain? You know, I mean, you can see many companies that add the blockchain now to the business to say, okay, we are blockchain based now. It's totally unnecessary. But if the blockchain is really the base of a business, of a new business, of a new innovative idea, it is up to the journalist to recognize that see some potential behind it and also see the potential story behind it. So
it's really about the story.
It is about the relevance. It is about the relevance. Is it relevant for us? You know, I mean, as an example, there has been this Swiss crypto-based company that used the blockchain to build a real estate fund. And real estate in Switzerland is a huge business for banks. And the idea is quite innovative. The people behind it are viable. And that would have been a story that we would have looked at, and we did. Comes the plus factor. They hired a well-known PR company that pitched the idea to us. And I'm very open to say that PR firms play a large role in pitching stories, in pitching interview partners to media outlets, because they work as a filter. Of course, because we wouldn't be able to filter all those possible stories. So the PR firms, they work as a filter. And of course, I mean, if there's money behind it, they have more arguments to put their own resources into pitching a story. I don't want to say that they offer money if we do the story. That doesn't happen. And if it does happen, we say, you can offer us money, you can buy advertorial space on our website, which also happens. Mm-hmm. Not yet, not so much from crypto companies, but fintech companies do it quite regularly now on FinNews.
Banks as well?
Of course, yeah. I mean, that's our business model. That's how we make our money. Advertising, advertorials, stuff like that.
How do you set up a firewall between that line of business and, you know, the independent journalist?
Always remind yourself daily and on an hourly basis to your journalistic conscience. You know, I mean, it is the hard part of being a journalist and being an entrepreneur is to divide these two markets, the reader market and the advertising market, but you have to play both. And of course, they are linked together. And you always have to be conscious, am I still independent? If I accept this money from this bank, and am I going to write still objectively about this bank in the future? But I think we've done that quite good so far.
So, but let's say a big Swiss bank comes to you, right, and says, hey, we acquired a big part of this fintech company, and we kind of want to rebrand ourselves now as new and hip and you know, on track with the future. So can you help us do this? We're happy to pay for some ad space, but it would help if you also, you know, kind of wrote favorably about us. I mean, has that happened?
No.
Okay.
No. And I mean,
so they understand that they, yes, if they're advertisers, they cannot influence what you write about.
I think it's different. The advertising part of the banks, they know exactly how it works. You know, they say, okay, we invite FinNews to our wedding. You know, we have some great news, and we invite FinNews to and we place our content on them, our great content. We pay them for it, but they know that if something goes wrong or if there are hiccups, then FinNews also comes to the divorce and will write about it. So that part is dealt with quite professionally. The other thing is that we see from the communication side of the banks that do the strategic and the media communication, that they try very strongly to influence on what we write and how we write it.
In your journalistic work.
Yes. Yes.
But that's just normal press releases that they don't pay anything.
No, it's phone calls. It's threats.
Threats?
Oh, yes, yes.
How so?
Well, I mean, you know, they threat with repercussions.
If you write about certain things they did wrong?
Or? Yes. If, I mean, as a journalist, if you have the facts wrong, you have to correct them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if your interpretation is wrong, that's just a journalistic view. I mean, there is no such thing as pure objectivism in journalism. There's always like this subjective view of the author of the story. There's always an idea behind a story, how to do it, how can I get a new angle to a also already well-known subject, and so on and so on. And online is a quick business. Online also works with, you try to get the attention of the reader. So you might be a little bit aggressive in selling your story, by using a headline which sometimes, the bank or the financial institution that you write about might not appreciate, and that's where they come with threats and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. But they're usually
change the headline. You got the story wrong. That hurts our business. And if you don't change it, we are going to call the lawyers and so on. Yeah.
And then what do you do?
Well, I check the facts again. You know, if the facts are right, I don't see any reason to change the story. If facts are wrong, I change it, which can be easily done in the internet. You know.
Right. And then you correct it like it would be a professional's way to deal with it.
Exactly. Exactly. We always see the subjects we write about, the banks, financial institutions, companies that are in finance, we always see them as partners, not as enemies. So we always try to get the facts right. We always try to be fair, but since since we are financed through them, through advertising money that comes from the banks, from the financial institutions, their expectations might be sometimes a little bit different from what we think is good journalism.
Let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own, the Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today.
Have there been advertisers who said, you know, this is just not on my line anymore? That's not what I want to communicate about. I mean, for example, let's say you wrote about disruption through blockchain technology of banking,
mm-hmm.
as it happened there, that maybe a traditional financial institution said, we don't want to be on a platform that writes about that.
No.
Good.
No, so far not.
It wouldn't reflect well on that.
No. Innovation is a huge topic in the boards of every financial institution now. So if we write about blockchain-based finance and innovation in that kind of innovation and developments in those parts, it should be of interest of the banks and not of a minus.
Right. I mean, they would be denying that there's something happening.
Exactly.
And they would also show they're not part of it, so they want to attach themselves to the progress. Correct. Is there, I mean, comparing the way you run your business, your platform, what do you see when you compare how you do it with maybe the crypto press, those crypto platforms that write exclusively about ICOs, cryptocurrencies, where the whole sector is going, all the great things that happen? Do you see any differences there?
Well, yes. I mean, the crypto platforms that the journalistic crypto platforms, I mean, they have a lot more depth than we have. They have a larger overview of what's going on in the scene. Like I said, we try to be very selective in what we do about it. We always try to get the relevance out of it for our readers, which are still mainly in finance and in banks. And I mean, I would say that's the main difference. What I see, you know, on sites like Cointelegraph or whatever, I mean, there are so many, I can't recall all the names, is not that they are super uncritical promoters of their case. I would say it's rather the opposite. They're quite critical. They write a lot about manipulation, about flaws, about failures of ICOs. You can see a lot of that, I think, on those platforms. I think my observation is more that the, excuse me if I use the word, mainstream media, that they jump on the subject a lot more by just writing about price developments. You know, the price of Bitcoin has gone up, the price of Bitcoin has crashed. You know, you can produce stories on and on and on and on like that. Or what is also very popular is banker XY has said Bitcoin is going to crash, and this guy has said Bitcoin is going to revolutionize the currency system. You could go on and on and on like that and produce stories on a daily basis, just, you know, by doing name dropping. And I think I see that a lot of that in mainstream media, and I don't think that really is an added value to the reader by understanding what's going on in the blockchain and the cryptocurrency development.
Is that also a result of influence on them, or is it just a misunderstanding of what really matters?
I mean, it's in my belief, it's pressure to you know, to generate clicks
on clickbait.
Yeah, it's clickbaiting. I would say, you know, I mean, if you understand the mechanics behind a online news site, 50%, you know, on an average base, about 50% of the traffic of the readers, they come to your website through Google, through a keyword search. So if you put the right keywords into a headline, you have guaranteed more traffic. But that's probably very short view thinking, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Because you always have to see the value behind the story, you know. I mean, and readers aren't stupid. They click on the story. They click on a story, they think it's interesting and it's more of the same. The next time they might think twice to click on the story.
Yet it still influences the perception of what people have.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. I mean, you have seen that in the rational exuberance of the price development in Bitcoin last year, where you had this FOMO effect in it. I think that largely it was driven by that, you know, the fear of missing out. Many private investors who had gone through many crises in the past year and have probably lost quite a bit of money saw a chance in making a quick buck on jumping onto Bitcoin, and the media thankfully jumped on that story, you know, saying, A, Bitcoin is on the rise, wow, but those guys who buy it are stupid, wow, you know, I mean.
So zero value journalism.
Great headline. Bitcoin is going to $100,000, great headline. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not much behind it, in my opinion.
Huh, interesting. It's interesting that you pinpoint the more traditional media, you know, for this kind of behavior, even though they always hold up the flag and say, we're the real professionals, and all these new platforms that are ad-sponsored, you know, that you shouldn't believe what they write. They're all influenced by sponsors.
That discussion would lead somewhere else, I think. I'm not criticizing mainstream media. I think, I mean, what I see is that mainstream media is under an immense pressure, cost pressure. I mean, the disruption is huge. What publishing in publishing houses and media houses. I mean, that's a well-known story. And online journalism hasn't proven as being profitable yet, and especially on digital platforms of the mainstream media. I mean, they just operate with a with high costs, you know. I mean, they aren't profitable, so they always try to generate clicks, traffic, and I think that leads to strategies that can be related to clickbaiting.
Interesting. So that would make them maybe easy prey even for some people who wanted to influence the story.
Of course. I mean, if you look at the USA, the Trump election, the Trump presidency has led to quite a good business development in the online media space, because everything that's Trump related promises to be a good story and is being read. And I mean, if you look through the stories, what is relevant, you know, about this? Most of it isn't. Most of it is just social media chatter, press pickups, and stuff like that.
Yeah. How much of the story that the mainstream media reports about blockchain technology and about, you know, this whole narrative of this is changing everything and decentralization is coming, how much of that story that people read about in the mainstream media do you think is manipulated by somebody else?
I don't think much.
So it's really mainly the motivation is the clickbait?
Yes. No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say it's all clickbaiting. I mean, there are very serious journalists that have probably better knowledge about the whole blockchain technology, sitting in newsrooms much larger than this one. But I don't think they're being influenced now by whatever PR well, there might be PR companies behind it, but I think there's everywhere there are serious attempts of explaining blockchain technology, the potential behind it, the players behind it, and so on.
Mm-hmm. It's just that those news that are just in it for the headline, they kind of overshadow the real, deep.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. What's your personal view on, the potential of blockchain technology?
It is very interesting. I'm not an engineer, and I'm not an IT programmer, so I probably understand the concept of it, but I wouldn't be able to explain how to build a blockchain. But the concept behind it, as far as I understand it, is interesting. It mainly it leads to efficiency gains, right? And I think that's the main reason why the large banks are pursuing blockchain projects, so they can lower their cost base in transactional businesses, right? And but I also think that the blockchain might be just for that, for some part of transactional businesses. It's not all of them. I think one part that is, in my opinion, largely exaggerated is that the blockchain can replace mutual trust between two business partners, right? I think trust is, as always, a human component. It's based on human interaction. And the blockchain, what blockchain does, it wants to eliminate this human interaction by creating smart contracts that write down for eternity what two business partners have decided on. And I don't think that's going to work in reality in all parts of our economy or even our social life. I really don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Has your view changed over time, or has that always been your view?
Yes, it has changed as more as I know about the developments in blockchain. I've also seen quite a few blockchain projects, especially in Swiss banks, fail, which is okay. It's not a disaster. It's a normal thing that you try an innovation and it doesn't work, so you try the next one. Don't give up, banks, on it, because there is large potential in it. Because, I mean, one huge problem banks are carrying are their transactional costs, and if you can eliminate transaction costs, that's a big thing. I mean, that's the whole fourth industrial revolution is about that, to reduce transactional costs in producing goods or, you know, or in trade or whatever. And so there is large potential about it, in it, of course. Also, maybe one thing I see critically that is being sold as a huge advantage is this decentralized system. I mean, the large advantage of the decentralized system is, of course, that you cannot manipulate it, or you shouldn't be able to manipulate it. Once it has been written, it is written. You can change it from one computer because you know there, or from one platform because there are other platforms that will notice and correct the trial. But then again, from an efficiency point of view, it's super inefficient. You know, if you have information based on a eternal number of platforms, then not just one. And if a transaction has to be fulfilled on a super large base of platforms, except for one, I mean, I don't see the efficiency.
The whole mining inefficiency.
Of course. I mean, that's one big thing about Bitcoin, is the whole mining inefficiency and the huge amount of energy that it consumes. And I think that is one of the big flaws in the whole crypto and blockchain system. It's inefficient in my point of view, or in part inefficient.
Mm-hmm. How did you reach that conclusion? I mean, I personally, right, I'm not a programmer. Right, I have very little grasp of, you know, how some of these very advanced technologies, you know, really work. But I wonder, I mean, how do you go about understanding the technology?
Well, you try to read, you know, I mean, you read articles about it, and if you find an article interesting, or the person that stands behind something, you go into deeper research, start reading books even, and it's just I mean, it's the task of a journalism to get as much of a broad view about a topic that you write about as possible. And of course, blockchain is a very large topic, and you can go really deep. And I mean, you have to ask yourself, is this going to help my reader if I let all my knowledge out on him, technical stuff that you can read on Wikipedia? I don't think that's my task. I'm trying to give directions and opinions.
If somebody wants to know more about blockchain technology, right? I mean, they don't have you're trained in doing research, right? And in then objectively reporting about it. So, but how, if somebody just wants to inform themselves about what this technology can do, or what maybe projects are that have promise, how would you recommend they go about that?
Well, I mean, if you just want a short explanation, you can always Google it, right? I mean,
but then you have the problem that you basically have all this clickbait coming up.
Yeah, but as a user, I don't care.
Well, but as a user, that it will not be a good research strategy, right? Because you'll first see all the clickbait that was generated just to, you know, push one side of the story. So, but it will never get you deep, right, into a certain...
That's true, but you have to start somewhere. I mean, you have to have a starting point just to get a general idea. I think the media is a pretty good source of information. But I think if you want to go deeper, you should actually start reading books. You know, there's a super large variety of new books in the market that explain the blockchain in a quite... in a way that is understandable for the non-technic freak.
Peter, you explained before the way you go about both funding your news platform, but also then maintaining independence from the advertisers, or maybe the opinion that they like to see spread in the news. Do you sometimes get criticism for this, for your commercial business model?
Yes, we do. We do I mean, not criticism, but what one question that we are regularly asked by peers, by other journalists, is, are you truly independent? And from our company structure is completely independent. But the next part of the story is how do we make our money? How do we pay our rent for the offices, and how do we pay our salaries? It's, of course, the money to do that comes from the people that we write about. And that does create a conflict of interest. Not so much for us, but for the reader. I mean, if the reader sees, you know, you open the FinNews website and you see the whole website is framed by a huge advertising by a pretty well-known bank, and there might by chance also be an article about that bank on our website, on our platform, which, you know, reports about good results or whatever, or reports about personal changes and stuff like that. One, the reader might ask himself, it's kind of odd, right? And it might look odd, but actually it doesn't have much to do with each other. What we do is, I mean, if we have large campaigns, like a branding campaign that uses a lot of advertising space, we try not to report on that bank or on that financial institution on that particular day, because that would raise eyebrows. Like I said, it raises questions mostly from peers. And it raises demands also from smaller players among the financial institutions that expect us that we write about them just like that, because they are now here and in their point of view they have a super business and they expect us to write about them always in a positive way, and I mean, it's not that easy. That doesn't happen. It might also, like I pointed out before, it might also in some ways be a disappointment for a bank if they get, you know, if they get bad press through FinNews while they have an advertising budget, a marketing budget, and that is, I don't know, has a certain amount of thousands of Swiss francs, you know, that might raise disappointment. There might be even phone calls. But then again, if you as a journalist, you always have to be able to say, was I fair or was I not? Is my reporting fair or not? And if it's fair, if the facts are right, there is no argument. You know, we have to do it and we do it. I mean, I can give you many examples reports from FinNews that have not been in favor of a bank, which is quite important as a business partner for us. So that's, you have to have two conscience as an entrepreneur and as a journalist if you are on a platform like ours.
How did you originally get into journalism?
Through writing. I must say through reading. You know, first was reading, then was writing, and then was then came the will to change the world. Right? in my juvenile years, also the belief of the importance of the media as the fourth column in a democratic state. And I still believe that. It's super more relevant than ever. Well, you could always say that in every period of time, but now again. And I was, you know, there was is a portion of idealism behind it. Some skills I have, I guess, you know, I'm I could say I'm good at journalism. I'm better at journalism than being a gardener or a cook or a banker. So yeah, that's how it happened. And I started in my, I don't know, late teens, writing for outlets, and then went on as a student to earn some money on the side, and got my first job in a small TV station as a VJ, as a video journalist, which so far has been my most interesting job, I think, but also the toughest. And then, you know, I went on from there.
Mm-hmm. It's cool. I mean, the idealism part I like, and it's interesting that it's kind of, I mean, a lot of people in this whole blockchain and crypto field also have a lot of idealism, right? I mean, definitely at the very beginning, maybe even more than today, you know, where so much money is involved. But has that ideology of the whole crypto and blockchain narrative, has that also somehow spoken to you or resonated with you?
Yes, of course. One of the most difficult things being a journalist is leave your personal opinions, leave your personal passions or whatever aside when you write about something, which is impossible. Right? I mean, you compromise always. I mean, you write about a subject that you like or you don't like. The article might lead to that you... Afterwards, you like the subject because you dig deeper into it, you find it interesting, you change your opinion about it. But most of the articles are opinionated by any journalist. Maybe, you know, the agency journalists at Reuters or Associated Press the least, but in newspapers, it's something that readers expect from you, you know, that you have an opinion about a subject that you write about. So that has been an influence, of course, because, I mean, if you look at the past 10 years, what has happened in the financial system with, you know, the financial crisis, with the central banks doing their thing, doing their experiment with flooding the markets with liquidity, and nobody knows what's going to happen. No, it's an experiment that has never been done, that could have potential fatal consequences for economy and society. So far, they have done a great job, but you never know. But their acting and the acting of government carrying huge debt with them and no idea how to get rid of the debt, and in combination with monetary policy has, of course, raising questions about, you know, what is going to be the consequence? How is this going to end? Can it be turned around? You know, and I think the cryptocurrency, the blockchain idea, the cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, to start with, the main idea is to create a system that is not under control of the state, of a government, or a central bank. Which is a very interesting idea, and there's ideology behind it, economic theory, libertarianism, and so on, which are all ideas. You know, as a journalist, you come across them, and some of them have something for them, some of them not. But in that context, it has come into my conscious, the blockchain and the whole idea behind it. Personally, I think, always think when there is an ideology behind it or a religion, there are dangers attached. You know, is it really going to help society, or is it just going to be for the use of a special kind of people that support those ideas and beliefs?
Yeah, we don't know.
We don't know.
Yeah, right. What would you like to see change in the way the communication is taking place in this whole crypto and blockchain ecosystem?
I don't know. I'm not really in a, I don't think I'm in a position to, you know, to give advice. I think I understand that there is a lot of hype, that there is a lot of competition growing, and there are a lot of paths that have an open end to a seemingly bright future, bright financial future, or whatever. And I understand that you have to promote that, that as a company, as an individual that has an idea, that puts money in, into it, that puts emphasis and passion into it, that you communicate your idea as a great thing. I think what I would like to see a little bit more is maybe a self-regulating mechanism in the whole scene by, you know, by naming and shaming members of that community that are only in it for the money, you know. Because those people don't really help the movement, I think, the movement, the development. I would, if I could give an advice, I would. It would be in that direction. But I think, I mean, there are associations, and there are many bright and reliable people that are already on that, that try to take a little bit the steam out of it and put it on a more realistic base.
And what about the journalism, you know, the reporting about blockchain technology and crypto? Is there anything that you would like to see, you know, evolve?
Well, I mean, what always helps is more understanding, and that will happen as blockchain evolves as part of an economic system. That is going to happen. Also, you know, understanding about cryptocurrencies, the financial system itself, and the effect of cryptocurrencies on a financial system, that always helps if there is more understanding in newsrooms and in newspapers that write about it. Maybe a little bit less focus on Bitcoin and, you know, the price development. I think that's, I mean, it's a boring subject, in my opinion. Of course, it's not boring because there's money behind it, and that's mostly, those are the easiest stories to make, but it's not a sustainable way of reporting news, I think.
Peter, that was really interesting and very insightful. So thanks a lot for giving such a deep overview of what you're observing and also some of the trends and your own opinion. I really appreciate that, and thanks a lot for taking time today.
Thank you. It was interesting for me too.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guests and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.